Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
And welcome to the fourth of our podcast recorded at Word in Your Park on Saturday the 17th in Holland Park. And who else could it be but Danny Baker, who we managed to winkle out of his you know, place where he normally ekes out a solitary. Barely exchanging a word with a human being, you know. We said, you've got to come out and meet people, you know, be in the sunshine. And so he reluctantly agreed to do it, didn't he, Mark?
He did. He was, oh God, he was hilarious. Now we got something out of the shy and retiring cove. But including, and I'd say it's worth hearing for this alone, an unbelievable spontaneous riff that he started about the music hall legend Bud Flanagan. Wasn't that amazing?
Just basically
reading a book about Bud Flanagan, which I think reading on the way down.
This is classic. This is, you know, like my children always used to say to me when they had creative writing classes to do. They used to say, it's all right for you, interesting things happen to you. I said, no, not true at all. More interesting things do not happen to certain people. It's just certain people know how to make a story.
Exactly.
It's as simple as that. Oh, Danny does.
He must have done 10 minutes on the early life of Bud Flanagan, age 14, stowing away in an ocean liner going to America.
Extraordinary stuff.
And then you get his idea for a Beatles documentary, which is good too. And another fantastic story he told was about a promoter, do you remember, in South London, who locked himself in his porter cabin to avoid the wrath of the acts that he'd booked. It's just simply brilliant. Really worth hearing.
What are you going there?
That will all become apparent.
Oh, he's got props.
Thank you very much. Hey, Broadway, have you missed me? I nearly missed this place. I came here, and apologies to Gary. He was 5 minutes away from the end of his act. And his interview, he's not got an act as such, is he? And he was just finishing. I could not find this place. I've never been to Holland Park in my life. Sorry, I genuinely haven't. And in my memory, you came out of Holland Park Station and there was Holland Park, because that would make sense. I've been at a Holland Park Station and I walked up and down here and up and down here, because on your description, it just said turn left into Holland Park. But that doesn't... You know that book in the 80s? Kit Williams put a book out in the 80s called Masquerade, where somewhere in Britain was a little tiny golden rabbit buried. Finding this place today. And I was so... I mean, I hate being late for anything, and I say I missed a bit of Gary's, but and here we are, and anyone who's ever been to Florida knows this is exactly the kind of space where they usually put on animal acts. They have a cockatoo come on stage and ride a little bike. Pig comes out, serves drinks. Funny monkey comes around and counts. Anyway, good to be here, everyone. And it's been, I said, the first time I've been out in 18 months. We're supposed to finish it up last four. I wouldn't count on that.
There's an opera has to take place here later on.
Yes, there is.
So,
sorry, I do apologise, David. I'm so sorry. One thing I meant to start with, and not how I found this place, this could not be a more August date, and this is true. 17th of July as we speak. This, in the rock and roll calendar, is one of the... Boom! This is solid, because on the 17th of July, 1765, William Grenville resigned as Prime Minister, to be replaced 1 hour later by Lord Rockingham.
This sounds straight out of Blackadder.
Exactly. Anyone who knows Hootsman, I didn't know Lord Rockingham was a real person.
Real person.
I had no idea that Lord Rockingham was an actual real person, and that's how far ahead they were back in the days of 1765. They brought in Hootsman as their prime minister. His name was Harry Robertson, who was played the Lord Rockingham. But here's the thing. The only thing we know for sure about Harry Robertson, who was Lord Rockingham's 11, is that his name wasn't Harry Robertson. His name was Harold Robinson, right? And he made loads of those kind of gimmicky records. But when he first got his check from Decca after having a hit with Hootsmon, where he was an A&R man and arranger, it was made, his name was Harold Robinson. It was made out of Harry Robertson. But in those days, to go to a bank and get that change would have been impossible. So he just thought, what am I? He just opened another account in that name and became that person because of a check, his paycheck. But many years later, and he was on loads of novelty records, as well as being Prime Minister in 1765, he was on loads of novelty records, but also, he is the person who arranges the strings on Nick Drake's Riverman.
I was going to say.
Same fella.
Sandy Denny albums as well.
Yes, he does. Yes, Sandy Denny
the
albums.
Same guy?
So there you go. Him. It shows you now what a farce we've got in government, because in the old days, they were versatile.
Yeah.
Anyway, welcome everybody. Sorry.
I've got to ask the obvious question, because this is a kind of polite relation of the Rock Festival. Have you ever been to a Rock Festival?
Nope. No, not for a second. No, not by accident or design, or just never have done. You told me you hadn't, and then revealed about most of them in the early 70s.
I went to the early 70s once, and then I had a Glastonbury phase. But there was a phase when I was at the NME where I couldn't stand the idea of staying overnight. Reading, you went to Reading, didn't you?
I've been and seen a couple of acts. You know, I used to go to the Crystal Palace Dyers. The summer to me is, you know, but people, there's nothing against it. I just never have done it. There's the Irma Bombeck line I always quote, you know, some people like to go back to the land, I like to go back to the hotel. And I always think, I've never had the my mates would never camp out somewhere to see a bunch of groups. So I've never been to a festival, but I could have seen the Stones in Hyde Park. I could have seen, I mean, that's not necessarily a festival, but I live in central London. And what's that, 69?
69.
I remember sitting around in our, there used to be a concrete boat in our estate, we all gathered on, and there was a few of us who liked rock music and stuff, and they said, should we, the Rolling Stones are playing in Hyde Park, which is easier to find than this one, by the way. And the number one bus would literally go from our estate, 27 minutes, you're at the Hyde Park corner. And we thought, should we do that? What's it cost to get in? Nothing, that's what I'm saying. Should we go up there and see the Rolling Stones? There'd be a load of people, wouldn't there? Well, it will, but we ain't doing nothing. And we sat around for ages discussing whether we should go and see the Stones. And then Peter King, who had no interest in music, came over and basically said, I'm going swimming. I said, well, we're just going to go and see the Rolling Stones. He went, I'm going swimming. Don't you like this? And I said, Southwark Park, open air Lido. And he said, I'm going to go swimming. And the conversation kind of came around to his point of view. So instead of going to see the Stones in Hyde Park, we all went swimming, right? But that I always think is a perfectly legitimate alternative. I marvel at people who were in the right place at the right time. Our dear friend Rob Chapman, RC Scribbler, he seems to have known what was going on all the time. We just used to bumble along. Oh, Rolling Stones, we're going to see them another time for free, 20 minutes
away. His entire life is about being in the right place at the right time.
It is, you know. And having the right
Nick Drake came on for his third song.
Yeah, and he had the drop on it then. I never had the drop on anything in my life.
So who have you missed?
Oh, tons of people.
Who have you not seen?
Tons of people. My son wants to wring my neck every time we meet. It's got nothing to do with music. Anyway, but no, yeah. When he says, we all can think of who we could have gone and seen, but you didn't. You didn't. You know, you look and say, like you say, Nick Drake or any band you want to name. They were playing less than 20 minutes away and you didn't go. You just didn't go. I mean, a Pink Floyd, for example, you know, you look at, and all right, I was 12, 13, but I was pretty hip 12, 13 year old. But you pick and choose your gigs you go to, but you just never went. Now, surely that's true of all of us. And those who did are either liars or just, you know, crackpots. You didn't know what was going on.
So what's the best gig you ever saw?
Best. Average White Band at the Marquee. That was the best night I ever had. And that may not be the greatest band, but I'll never lie about it. That and Emerson, Lake and Palmer at the Pavilion. Because for me, at the Pavilion at Christmas, they played the cinema. Yeah. And we had good seats and we had a great night. Now, I may listen back to recordings of those, although the Average White Band were great, and think that ain't the greatest. But for me, it was. I can't remember a song in the set list, but those are the two nights. Oh, wasn't that great? And I think I've told you before, when you used to come out the Marquee, it was so little and so packed and so great with the Average White Band that the sweat used to fall off the ceiling and you get that white line across your black shoes, and that would be human sweat reduced to salt.
Tide mark.
Now, that's a good gig.
That's
a good gig. Yeah, you've actually got human remains on your shoes. By the way, these are from, these are the David Bowie range of Vans. Honestly, they are. Look, that's Black Star. Thank you very much. I've also got the ones with the green and blue that are the dots from the Space Oddity album. Oh, yeah. Don't just sling this look together. But in the marquee, it would literally have a drop from the ceiling. But days I didn't mind going to, the Crystal Palace ones. I'll tell you, here. So, where I live, another easily accessible park is Southwark Park. It's easy. You can see the trees. You come out the station. There it is. Unlike this, you know, Narnia we're in now, this Brigadoon. My mate managed to screw out of... Oh, no, managed to... convince Southwark Council that what we need, and it still runs, the Southwark Park Festival, and it's had some turns. He's only got a limited budget, true story this, that, you know, on days like this, it's usually in July. I don't think it's happening this year for obvious reasons. At any rate, his name's Phil, and he's a great old friend of mine, and he's in charge of it, and he does what he can with the budget. He's had like the real thing, Chaz and Dave used to do it, headlining £1,500 or whatever it is for the top of the bill. It'd be an all day thing. Anyway, about maybe 10 years ago, he had Joe Brown booked, which is a good booking. Joe Brown booked. And elsewhere on the bill, there were various people who had one hit. And Wee Georgie Wood was on. Wee Georgie Wood must have been 91 by then, no joke. Wee Georgie Wood was on. Here's a man who, you know, topped the bill when Flanagan and Allen were on their way up. Honestly. So Wee Georgie Wood is on, and he's on about two before Joe Brown. And this happens in these things. Joe's probably got another gig after it, might have had one before. He turns up about an hour before it. But Wee Georgie Wood, and I can't understand this, overstayed. His act went on really long. He comes from that area, and you know, a crowd like this there and in the park, it's all free. And he played and he played, and they were going, get off. And he went, here's another one you might not remember. I'm telling the bloke, put the tape on. And Wee Georgie Wood was supposed to have done 25 minutes, did an hour. Now, with Southwark Council, you've got, as you know here, a licence to bang. Anyway, my mate Phil was like, oh, Wee Georgie Wood, he wouldn't get off, and now we're all behind, and I don't know what we're going to do. I can't remember who followed him. Remnants of a 60s act came on and played some songs, and they went a little over as well. Now, he has to go back to the little porter cabin where Joe Brown is, and Joe's person answers the door, and there's Joe in the background. Hello, mate. He said, hello, yeah, I spoke to you. Yeah, but Joe, I'm so sorry. You're booked to do 50 minutes, yeah. He said, could you do half hour? Because we've got to close. And he said, I felt so bad. He said, and Joe Brown, who's just the gentleman, greatest, nicest fella, looked at him and went, half hour? I've got to cut down to half hour. What for? And he said, well, Wee Georgie Wood. So he said, could you do half hour? So Joe's, go on then, I'll do half hour, right? So he said, I feel so bad. At any rate, this next act, whoever they were, A. Tremolos, A. whoever, they went over as well. Now he knows it's 25 to 10. He's got to finish at 10, no matter what. Boom, out go the lights. That's the end of the all-day festival. So on comes Joe, eventually, looking thunder at him from the other side of the stage. Joe's only got about 22 minutes now, but he hasn't told him that. So Joe does the act, and he's brilliant. He throws everything in a sharp relief. And he realises, well, he said, ladies and gentlemen, I better wind this up. I'd like to have played more, but I've been told I've got to finish. My fault. Anyway, here's a song that a lot of you might know means the world to me. It's a song I played with George Harrison, and it's a right round of applause. It's going to be See You in My Dreams. So thank you very much. I'm sorry about the short set. But here we go. And he gets that ukulele and says, I'll see you in my dreams. What Phil at that point remembers is there's a firework display set to go off at exactly 10 o'clock. Honestly. And Joe's like, see you in my... He threw down the mic. He walked up. He grabbed hold of him and said, I'm never fucking doing this again. How could you? And my mate ran and hid in a porter cabin with a bottle of beer for an hour until it was all over. Joe was halfway through the most emotional song in his library, and the fireworks just lit the sky. Bang, bang. You couldn't hear a word. Poor old Joe Brown. Oh, Oh, Dom, look at that. I do apologise, everybody. Actually, this beer, I looked on the back. It comes from Spa Road in Bermondsey, if you're drinking this. It's about five streets from where I was born. I could have saved myself all the heartache of getting here by hopping on the brewer's dray this morning. I'd have been in plenty of time. Anyway, I'm sorry. Where were we?
Well, I was going to just to ask. I was reading a thing about the Sex Pistols this morning, the big controversy about the Danny Boyle film and the legal action about the music. You know. And I was thinking of asking you, are there any great rock and roll stories that have not yet been made into a biopic?
There haven't.
Should be.
Not in rock and roll terms, I don't think, because unless... I mean, obviously, Mark is far and away the world's authority on the Beatles. But sometimes I think... I mean, I watched that last Beatles documentary 8 days a week about their last dates in the States, ending up at Candlestick Park. And it's great. It's good. I mean, it's good. But in that, we have, like, God bless him, but Whoopi Goldberg, and I think Eddie Izzard at one point, holding forth about it. And the film seems to focus for 60% of its time on the girls in the audience. Why there's never been a thorough one of tracking those women down now? They never do that. It's all a load of blokes. And what this meant, with great respect, Mark, what this meant was and how this... Those, my sister, as you know, climbed Buckingham Palace gates, was on the front of every newspaper. I talk to my sister now, and if I say something casual, like... Because Ringo, how old's Ringo more than Paul? And she would say, he was born this date and that date. We went over to his house once and tried to deliver a birthday cake. We did it to John. We gave John a birthday cake and a shirt we bought for him with a Union Jack. And that story, to me, it's great having the nuts and bolts and the who, the what, the why, the when, but the visceral, that moment, what it actually impacted on. And what you need, and I've never, you know, played to a gallery, but what you need is those girls, because not the blokes. If you look at all the early photos of the Beatles, it's 80% girls in the audience. Yeah. They were the wind beneath their wings. But they've never been traced. No one's ever gone around and said, day to day, how did it impact you? And whether they say, you know, I had to up work one day, or what happened was, and my dad said this, and another day we hitchhiked 45 miles, that to me is worth a million people saying, oh, yeah, you know, Sergeant Pepper was recorded here and all of that. So you need that, but I've never seen a great documentary on the actual people who were in at the same time as the Beatles, long before, you know, the boys found out the Stones were hollow, if you will. Come on, face facts. Anyway, but that's the film I'd like to see. But that, against that, I'm reading a book now, and if you were subscribed to the Treehouse on Patreon, you'll know this because I was raving about it. I do a thing on there on the Patreon thing called Now That Never Happened, Did It? Which is where I take a showbiz autobiography and give a flavour, because no matter how famous some of these people are, I'm talking about showbiz types. We've done Danny LaRue and Mike Yarwood and Cliff Richard. When they come to sit down to do their autobiography, they actually haven't done much. And so they sit with a ghostwriter and make stuff up. And I'll read a passage from the book and we all join in and say, now that never happened, did it? Mike Yarwood is so thin, I know this is not strictly rock and roll stuff, he spends 2.5 pages talking about when he bought an orange juicer once, right? And to no end, I'd seen a man in the pub and you could do 10 glasses of orange juice, but as it turned out, I didn't need 10 glasses of orange juice, so we put it back under the kitchen sink. That's it. That's the highlight of it.
And it's like an Alan Partridge sketch.
Exactly. Exactly. So we do this thing on there. And so I was looking along the shelves in the week, and this does come around to the great non-rock and roll stories, because we flatter ourselves that, of course, you know, rock music has some kind of different lineage and story than other forms of entertainment. And I tell you what, I took it down. I've got you with me. I took this down from the shelf. That. That's, I'm really not on the train here. That's Bud Flanagan's book. My Crazy Life. Exactly. It's been on my shelf 35 to 40 years and I've never read it. And because I thought I know what it's like. I'll get round to it one day. It's going to be core in them days, you know, what it was like. Because I know he's from Whitechapel. I've never read anything like it in my life. If Tom Waits wrote a novel, this is it. When Dylan, I'm not joking, you'll find out I'm telling the absolute truth in a second. When Dylan fantasizes about, you know, I did this and I used to do that, this bloke actually did. This is the, and I ain't saying this for effect, you know, you can tell I hadn't even planned. This is the greatest rock and roll book I've ever read. Bud Flanagan, born in 1896, right? We all know Flanagan and Allen underneath the arches strolling, and you think, well, it's just some anodyne old musical act. Don't kid yourself. Here's a bloke who was born from Polish immigrants, 10 of them living in two rooms in Whitechapel. His brothers go and join the army. At 14, Bud decides this poverty in school ain't for me. So at 14, one day, he gets up and doesn't go to school. Instead, inspired by films he's seen, he wants to go to America. So he walks to Southampton. Walks, doesn't tell his mum, doesn't tell him, walks to Southampton, sees goes to the dockside, and there's all the chalkboards advertising positions on the boats, joins a queue, gets to the front. He's 14, but looks 17. They say to him, what do you do? And he's heard people say, I'm a chippy, or I'm a kitchen staff. And he just says, I'm an electrician. Lovely. We could use you. When can you leave? And he says, any time. And they say, well, you ain't got anything with you. He says, no, but I can go any time. And they said, well, go over there. He'll give you two uniforms, two pairs of boots. Da, 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 da. That one up there is leaving for New York, right? 5 o'clock tonight. You're still, yep, off he goes. He gets on this boat, is assigned a berth, assigned a bunk. The first thing he has to do while he's still in port is put in light bulbs. He can do that. As they leave port, he's asked to go and strip down a machine. And they say, well, Rob, what do you reckon about this? And he says, and he bursts, it's a mate, I'm not an electrician. And he goes, oh, no. He said, another one. He says, you kids always get on the boat. He says, what's going to happen to me? He said, go down the kitchen. So he goes down the kitchen, starts washing up. Now, I'm pre-seeing it. So he washes up on the way to New York and does all kinds of jobs, falls in with this other kid who says, I'm jumping ship in New York, I ain't coming back. He says, I want to do that. And they do, and he describes how it was done. They just get off that. You always, an old lady, Denver bags, have a look. If no one's looking, run towards the sheds. He does this, but this woman gives him a $5 tip. Away he goes. And now he's in the east side of New York. He walks through the gates. Now, having walked out to go to school one morning, he's in the east side of New York, and he describes it better than Chaplin does in his book, which is a great one, how poverty-stricken it was. And he says, I've jumped out the frying pan into the fire. This is worse than Whitechapel. He spends 6 hours wandering around the, you know, east side of New York, describing it brilliantly, until he thinks, I'm going to have to get back on this ship. And as he does, he hears a voice on the other side of the road go, Bobby, which he was known as in London. Now, it's a kid from his district who left a year before, an older kid. I thought it was you. Offers him in two rooms. And I hate to say it, we ain't even got to the astonishing part of this yet. Offers him to stay in two rooms. He says, I'll give it a go. He says, how can I get work? He says, go to this bloke. You can sell newspapers. He starts as a newspaper seller in New York, pre-First World War. He does that for 6 months till he's outside a hotel, and a fellow says, we need kids at Western Union. Can you join us? So he goes to work with Western Union delivering telegrams. While he's at Western Union, he's making a few quid, but nothing like to get out of trouble. But he works up a little act with another one, does a few auditions, goes bottom of the bill in some things. Anyway, I'll try and price it. Eventually, there, like in those days, there was 20 acts on a bill, and you get $5 eight times a day, whatever. So he starts this, and then he goes off on the road. Now, hang on, 1 minute. Let me read you this.
Do the folks back home know any of this?
Now, they said, do you want to come on the road with us? He said, well, I've got a good job at Western Union. I said, come on the road. So he says, from there, I was doing 8 shows a day, often 9 on Sundays. I went to Seattle, San Francisco, Chicago, New York, Boston, and Philadelphia. From then to Milwaukee, Sioux City, Kansas, Butte, Montana, Portland, Oregon, and Los Angeles. While we were in Los Angeles, I heard a rumor that we could possibly go into Australia. This was the best trip I ever took. I found myself in Honolulu, Tahiti, Rarotonga, and finally Wellington. Standing on the deck at 6 o'clock one morning, we saw the bird of paradise magic of Tahiti, but it all turned to ashes when we went ashore. Behind the vivid facade, there were wooden hovels and listless natives scratching their sores in the harsh sunlight. Scores of Chinese labourers and stevedores staggering under their burdens. A beggar stood waiting for us with elephantitis in his legs, swollen as big as a tree. Now, Tom Waits would die for that imagery, right?
That's fantastically written.
From there, I hate to say it, but he goes around Australia until he hears that the First World War's broken out. He thinks, I'd better go home. He works, gets enough to get his passage back to San Francisco, but doesn't know how to get to New York, where he's got enough for a boat. So he starts doing the hobo life. Down at the rail yard, they start saying to him, listen, kid, what you do, these 100 trains here, that's leaving for Baltimore. Get that, and you can get that, and another one, and another one into New York. Now, how you ride the rails is this. Not like in the films where you open it up and jump in. You climb this ladder, you get on the top, and you work your belly until you look down in the glass portals and see if it's empty of grain. Then when we slow down, come down the side and get in. Anyway, he does all that. He learns all this. He hangs out with his hobos until the police knock on the door and arrest him. Where I'm up to in the book now, he's doing 25 days in a Detroit prison. Now, you can read as many Eric Clapton autobiographies as you like.
No,
Bud Flanagan in the first five chapters make you think the music's better. But that, my friend, so when you say...
Haircut 100, might as well not put pen to paper.
Exactly.
There's just no point, is there?
Exactly, my friend. I'm sorry about that, but I'm enthused with that.
So you're due to go on the road. Oh, you're going to
show
us
due to
what's
go on the road.
In this.
So I forgot this.
What have you got there, first of all? Go on.
Now everyone knows I'm bald. Sorry about that. That's what I meant to do. Oh, thank you. I meant to do that. Oh, the other thing I brought, because we're going to talk about great summer records, yeah? Okay. There's only, I think, you know, we're all of a certain age here. Forgive me if you're outside of that. But when you think of summer albums, you know, getting the gang together and going down the coast, them long, hot summer days, just nothing matters anymore. You know, and the wind blowing through, you're young, you're never going to be like that again. Everyone's got a summer album like that. But I've always thought nothing sums that feeling of freewheeling, happy-go-lucky spirit as much as Neil Young's On the Beach. Because if ever an album was ever mistitled, it is On the Beach. It's not the Brian Wilson take, is it? And there is the 8-track.
Cheery Cliff Richards song, is it?
No, it's not. No, it isn't, exactly. When it came out, I thought he may have covered that.
The Bossa Nova,
he may have covered it. I do apologise.
So you're due to go on the road with Whispering Bob in the most postponed tour since...
harrisandbaker.com. Bob Harris and I are going on the road. We have differing styles, but therein lies the evening's out. And I don't know if on the last one of these I did, I told you how it came about. It's the only other time I've been out.
You didn't know, tell us, because I think, have you only done one, or am I imagining?
We've done one.
It's just
we did one.
But on the basis of that, you've booked a whole national tour.
Well, it's the only, well, it was just before lockdown. And his wife was also his manager. Called me out of the blue and said, Danny, Bob's doing a thing, a private thing at a local festival in the Midlands, but he doesn't want to do it on his own. He's wondering if you want to do it with him. Now, I must be absolutely honest, I thought, do what? It was just a little one of these local arts festivals. But, you know, I know both her and Bob, and I said, yeah, of course. Forgot all about it. Rather like today, because as we know, dates don't just roll around, they leap right out at you. So when you emailed me on Thursday and said, you're all right for Saturday, aren't you? Oh, shit, Saturday. Okay, but here we are. Anyway, so off I went. I got a train up to a place in the Black Country. I didn't know where this place was or what it would be. So, and it was just a little local arts festival based in a hotel. And I got there first, and I saw this little room, a third of the side of this that we were going to play in, and I hadn't given it a thought what we were going to do. And Bob turns up. Hi, Danny, hi. I said, hello, Bob, how's it going? So what do you think? What should we? I won't even try, you know, because as we know, it's very Bob's. I once described Bob's voice as being like a vibrator buried in 6 feet of sand. But it... And it is. What do you think we should do? So I said, well, we'll just go out there and tear it up. Now, that is my style. It's not Bob's style. What do you mean? So I said, well, honest, Bob, trust me, you know, how long we got to do? Oh, we've got to do an hour and a half. I said, oh, my God, hour and a half. I'm going to get a dust out of my throat. I said, but nevertheless, honestly, I said, all right, we can do it. We'll just tell stories. Yeah, but when you mean tell stories? I said, this is honestly backstage. I said, Bob, trust me. We'll do the first half. I'll ask questions of you. You ask questions of me. And then it was a stage like this. And I said, then we'll ask people there, if you've got a question, write it on a bus ticket, a post-it note, an envelope, put it on the stage and we'll walk up and we'll read it. That seems a bit... I said, no, honestly, that's the gag. And we walk to this pile and take it out and read the question. Okay, anyway, it went wonderfully. It went fantastic. I didn't know a lot about Bob, you know, because unlike me, he's not very, you know...
What was he telling stories about then?
Well, he was... I mean, I would say to him... I said to him, you know, because I didn't know him in the first bit, I just said, so the first, you know, Bob was the first record you bought, stuff like that. And he was very... I didn't know. And then we got round to Bob. Who can't you bear? Who is, you know, and Bob Harris is lovely. He couldn't, you know, he said, oh, if I'm honest, Roxy Music. And I went, what? I don't like Roxy Music. I said, what? And teasing stuff out of Bob, and it was not one hard trip to do it to me. And I said, we've ever been in a band, and he has. But it was literally ad-libbing like this. And then I said to him, He said to me, "Were you ever in a band?" And I said, which you probably all noticed, sir, I said, "Yeah, Led Zeppelin for 35 minutes, which is a true story, right? Everyone knows this." And I told this even, well, I said, well, how many, and like half a dozen hands went up. I said, well, I'll tell you this. And I told it as quickly as I could and how I was really, really in Led Zeppelin for 35 minutes. And it went great. And then we did the break and we came back and we did the questions and he was really enjoying himself. He said, I thought there'd be a structure. And I said, well, there is, but the structure is. Here's two blokes who have been, you know, in longer than me. Like, he was Mark Bolan's best man. I didn't know that. No, best man at Mark Bolan's wedding. And anyway, so all of this, and it was always very much the, you know, the B-movie John Peel. But, of course, he has just as rich stories to tell, if not better. So we did the second half, and we wrapped it up. And we said, thank you very much. And we both thought, there's something here. You know, obviously, he gets as much time as me. I would never be as, you know, bumptious as that. And we finished, and he was really up for it. And his wife said, this is a tour. And somebody was there said, this is a tour. So it is. But we went for a drink, and I wasn't going to go for a drink afterwards. He said, come and have a couple of glasses of wine. And he was really up. And I was talking to him for ages, and somebody was saying to us, were you really in Led? I said, that story's true. I was in Led Zeppelin for 35 minutes. And I felt somebody goose me from behind. And I turned around, and it was Robert Palm. Right? It's absolutely true. Because it's the Arts Festival. I had no idea about this. The Arts Festival he basically underwrites in his where he comes from, in this nearby where he comes from. And he went, I remember that. It was at the Q Awards, you know, the thing takes place. And he went, that was a funny story. And I said, was that you laughing before it ended? And he said, yeah, yeah. And he had a great night. Now, I don't want to hold anyone to this, but had this gone ahead outside of COVID, it was going to be Harris, Baker and Plant. He enjoyed it so much. He said, I'd just love to tell stories. He said, outside of an interview, he said, I'd love to join. He may do. On some nights, we're going to have other people come out and join us. But that was all set in stone like everything else until now, but fingers crossed we start at the beginning of October again, and we've just added dates in Glasgow and all points beyond. But it is a terrific night. Yes, I can do stuff like this, but hearing Bob actually be unchained and challenged. Normally, for some reason, Bob's the kind of DJ that likes to tell you information about the record you just heard.
He does. He's also
That's the kind of fresh style he's brought to broadcasting. But the pair of us are, yeah, chalk and cheese. But it's genuinely a surprising night out because he said he hated Roxy Music. Why? Oh, all that, you know, Brian Ferry hated him. Even Bob Harris say that, and I teased a lot more out of him. And of course, he asked me, and again, treading on previous guest toes about Queen. And that got a lot of boos from the audience. But there's always a group you can't like. In fact, on my way here today, this is just another thought, when I couldn't find it and I knew you'd started. And I thought, oh, if I was on the radio, and them's were the days, going to see a band who starts too early. When you get there and they're on, you think, that's not them, is it? And you push open the door and you've arranged to miss the support band. Face facts, Gary. And they're already on. I've done that a few times. That's a horrible feeling. And they're already playing. And you make your way to your seat. 10cc I saw start early and finish early. They couldn't wait to get in and out of there. Mountain came on earlier than advertised. Quintessence were supporting them. So we arranged to miss Quintessence. But we missed about a quarter of an hour of Mountain. So again, if you're part of the Treehouse, let me know, please. Bands who started early or you nearly missed.
So any other groups that you didn't like then and you still don't like?
Oh, stacks of them. Yeah. I say that there's no group I really didn't I always make this joke about Queen. I didn't like Queen, but that's I've not no real. It's just funny to say that a lot of the time because they were neither Mott the Hoople, Roxy Music, Led Zeppelin, or Deep Purple, and they were these magpies who now are seen as originals and all of that. Yeah. Supporting Mott the Hoople was exactly where they should have been. So. I never did. But if other people do, that's fine. We're all too old for all of that, God knows. As I read the other day, we grew up in a world that has all but disappeared and died, as have we. It's a terrible thought, but that's it said, when people ask them, how old are you? It's an anagram. It should be, how are you old? And that's how I feel. That's exactly how I feel.
On that note, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh.
David Essex's brother.
We never got to that. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.